For about 34 of the 35 years that I've been having Christmas Eve services, most of them on time, not this time, but on time, I've done this reading called Christmas is for the Children. One year I skipped it, and one of the children who had come of age in the congregation came up to me afterwards and said, "You can't do that. That's my reading. This is what makes Christmas for me." Well, I do this in her honor, and not out of superstition and not offering it to you as the core that you must accept, but in the spirit of all of us grab on to different parts of a service, of a holiday, of a holy day, and of an experience. And we, in the Unitarian Universalist tradition, honor all of those parts that we find to form and inform our souls. Christmas is for the children. How many times have you heard that said and echoed the saying? How many times have you used this saying as an excuse to justify half-hearted celebrations or coldly practical observances? But Christmas is for the children. Only the wide eyes of childhood can encompass its potential beauties. Only uninhibited voices can do justice to the ancient carols. Only those who love without limits can forget prudence and price in their giving. Only those innocent of guile can cultivate goodwill and contribute to peace among the nations. Only with childish credulity may we enjoy the Christmas fantasies, and only with childish intuition sense the truths that underlie them. Christmas is for the children. But adulthood is an attitude and not an age. It's a matter of heart and not height. Adulthood is the social mold in which we imprison our spirits that they may take on the forms of the real world and forget the idealistic infinities of youth. Christmas is for the children. But let's all be children for Christmas. Let us listen to the old, old tales and cultivate the new, new hopes they imply. Let us laugh, sing, and rejoice with one another, forgetting the false dignities of age and the foolish divisions that have kept us separate from one another. Let's all be children for Christmas in our church, our homes, and especially in our hearts. When we strip away from Christmas all of the pagan tales and the miracle stories that cover the real miracle that's hiding in plain sight, the real miracle of life and of love and of existence, what we are left with, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, is a birthday party. Christmas really is a birthday party. And it's been a birthday party for thousands of years. In English, it might work out as a pun to talk about the birthday of the sun, S-O-N, but it's the birthday of the sun in Middle Eastern religion, of Mithra, of Saturn, of Al-Shamash. It is the renewal that we have of our spirits as the seasons promise to renew themselves. It isn't just about theology or Christology. It is about something that is so clear and obvious in our own lives. We are people who are tied to the earth. Most of our holidays and holy days tied to the northern hemisphere. We are also people who live, and that's a remarkable thing. Think of all of existence, of all of the star stuff, of all of the energy in the universe. Some of it takes the form of life. And some of that life is intelligent. And some of that intelligent life is in this room. And it's in us for a few moments, a few microseconds of this flash of light in between. We don't know. But we do know now that how and that we are is deeply wonderful and mysterious and exploring the how of it in science is not at all a contradiction. We can appreciate the how, and we can just be blown away by the fact of is. We are here, and we can do things and love things and hate things and make a difference in each other's lives. We are here, and we are not alone. We're not alone in life because we share it with so many good and wonderful and mostly kind human beings. And we're not alone in time either. We have histories. We come from places. And with any luck at all, we, in the form of our legacy, will pass on to others. And life will continue on this planet with other people. And what we do and what we choose in these moments that we have make a difference. We have stories to tell each other about where we come from and what we have seen. What a tragedy it would be, I think, if we just found ourselves existing at some age without any sense of past, without any sense of a journey, without ever having had any parents or grandparents or tribal stories or folklore, just being people in one time. And what a tragedy if we just arrived in this place. And what a tragedy if we just lived in that place, never passing on our life, our story, our experience, our wisdom, and our folly to another generation. One of the things that religions do is that they give us a story. They anchor us in time so that this flash of light isn't alone. There are dozens and hundreds and thousands of lights which together shine in the darkness to warm and to illuminate the paths of others. We come from someplace, and that's part of our story, and we pass it on to another generation, and that is part of our future. We could not have a paradise without a past and without a future. It is in our struggles to complete creation, to light up our little corner of the universe, to blow upon the embers in the hearts of others and fan them into a flame of warmth, that we find warmth, that we find meaning, that we give a legacy to the future. This is the season of light. This is the season of yes. We know that it is a dark and cold and frightening world out there. We know that in the dark we are on a level orange. We know that there is fear and we know that there is anger. But this season reminds us also that there is hope and there is love and there is a community of human beings of every race and religion who work together every day to make this world a little bit brighter, a little bit kinder, and a little bit more of a loving place so that our children and our children's children will have a good story to pass on to their children. I'm now adding a reading. Your order of service is only a rough guide and indication of what actually happens. We are not fundamentalistically tied to it. T.S. Eliot from The Journey of the Magi. A cold coming we had of it, just the worst time of year for the journey, and such a long journey. The ways deep and the weather sharp, the very dead of winter, and the camels, galled, sore-footed, refractory, lying down in the melting snow. There were times when we regretted the summer palaces on the slopes, the terraces, and the silken girls bringing sherbet. Then the camelmen, cursing and grumbling and running away and wanting their liquor and women, and the night fires going out and the lack of shelters and the cities hostile and the towns unfriendly and the villages dirty and charging high prices. A hard time we had of it. At the end, we preferred to travel at night, sleeping in snatches with the voices singing in our ears, saying that this was all folly. Then at dawn, we came down to a temperate valley, wet below the snow line, smelling of vegetation, with a running stream and watermill beating the darkness and three trees on a low sky, and an old white horse galloped away in the meadow. Then we came to a tavern with a wine leaves over the lintel, six hands at an open door dicing for pieces of silver, and feet kicking the empty wineskins, and there was no information. And so we continued, and arrived at evening, not a moment too soon, finding the place. It was, you may say, satisfactory. All this was a long time ago, I remember, and I would do it again, but set down, this set down, this. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt. I had seen birth and death, but thought that they were different. This birth was hard and bitter and agony for us, like death, our death. We returned to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. I chose to read and share the journey of the Magi with you because I think it's illustrative of a couple of very interesting and important points about our lives and our own journeys. It's about transitions. In T.S. Eliot, born a Unitarian, later became a real Christian. He became an Anglican, not an Episcopalian, an Anglican, and an Anglophile. Eliot was exploring the difficult transition that he had in his own spiritual journey, because the journey of the Magi is about a physical journey and a spiritual journey from one place to another place, and all of the difficulties that we have in leaving even bad places. The Magi were priests of Zoroaster. They were not kings in our sense of kings, but they were making a nice living, thank you very much. And they had their place in society, but they were still questing after something and left the security of those palaces and those girls and all that lovely sherbet. And they regretted that. And Eliot uses the word regret in the same way that the King James translation of the Bible talks about the Hebrews in the desert regretting the flesh pots of Egypt. It means missing something, even if it wasn't nourishing, it was known. I think that all human beings are in spiritual journeys, moving from areas of comfort to discomfort, areas of certainty, sometimes fairly smug, into places of extraordinary freedom that can be overwhelming and overpowering in its vastness like a desert, or distracting like being a king or a magi, a magus, in a palace. All of us are involved in those kinds of journeys, not just Unitarian Universalists who came from something and are going towards something, but everyone of every faith, if we are thinking, if we have the courage to examine ourselves and our values, we move. We move from certainty and security. Like a hermit crab, there are times when we are in between the safety of a carapace, of a shell, and we feel vulnerable and exposed. What should we believe? What should we value? What is the nature of our own journey? Eliot wraps up this poem with a seeming confusion about, well, I thought we were there for a birthday, but it seemed agonal. It was so difficult to go from one state to another, to transition from non-birth into life, as it is to transition from life into non-life, as it is to transition from childhood to adulthood, as it is to transition as we grow and move our physical homes and our spiritual homes. One of the great lessons of Christmas is that it really isn't about the facts. Nobody looks at the journey of the Magi and asks, were there really three of them? And where did they come from? And what was the nature of that star? Was it a supernova or was it a star? Was it an image from Exodus, the pillar of fire that guided them at night? We don't look for the literalness in the story of the three Magi. We've even given them three names that are not biblical. Trivia, anyone? Balthazar, Melchior, and Caspar, the friendly Magus. Yeah. It's not about the facts. One of the reasons that I love that Christmas is for Children reading is that it talks about withdrawing from the cold world of mere facts into a place that is fanciful. Christmas is not about what really happened. It's not about a date of birth or virgins or whether angels appeared to shepherds. It is about how hope and life appear to human beings. It is about the miracle of the word love becoming incarnated in every child. It is in seeing the miracle in every child and celebrating that miracle as we all stand by at birth from generation to generation. It is about ancient and eternal truths of the human spirit, that we need each other, that we need fancy and poetry and song and dance and art, that we need to understand that the very most profound experiences that we have in the world, we cannot put into simple words and just say true or not true. They are facts, not of faith as belief, but facts of faithfulness as we feel our bond with life, as we feel our bond with the terror of the setting sun and the hope that every sunrise brings to our hearts and the hope that every child brings to our world, and our duty to bring the treasure that is our life experience, the treasure that is our wisdom, the treasure that is our time, and bring it to the hungry and to the homeless and to the lost. What is the remarkable truth in Christmas is Jesus never did very much and yet made an enormous difference through his life in the world. He didn't raise armies. He didn't kill anybody. He didn't write a bestseller. He never went on cable TV. And he still is remembered. In fact, he didn't have a publicity agent until after his death. And that was Paul. And he still is remembered. What did he do? He fed people who were hungry. He comforted people who were afflicted. He healed people who were sick. He did the right thing as his values informed him to do them. What were the odds of some obscure carpenter in some obscure corner of the once mighty Roman Empire being remembered across the world when most of us couldn't name more than two or three Caesars at the very most? What were the odds of Martin Luther King, a poor black man and anonymous preacher in a Baptist church, having a national holiday named after him because he had a dream that he shared? What were the odds on Gandhi, a relatively modest architect in South Africa,
going to India and bringing down an empire through peace, through decency, through good works, through kindness, through seeing the humanity in his adversary, and therefore making his adversary deal with the humanity that was in him. What remarkable models human beings can be when we simply decide to do the right thing. Not the popular thing, not the political thing, not the easily spun thing, but simply to be in touch with those values that we hold inside our hearts and to act them out, not perfectly because we are not perfect, but as best we can in a world that needs the best of us. Christmas is that reminder, it is that inspiration that we can take steps towards being better in our world and making our world better for us having taken those steps. And it's even better when we take some of those steps together. Not necessarily synchronized and not as a marching battalion, but in the good company of people who love and who care.
This reading of one paragraph is what's known in the trade as an offertory homily, which is highfalutin talk for guilting you into contributing to the hungry and to the homeless. It was written by one of the great, great poets and clergymen of the 20th century, the Reverend Howard Thurman of San Francisco and All People's Fellowship, who built an intergenerational, interracial, interreligious congregation and led it on a mission of social gospel and involvement with the hungry and the homeless. And he wrote, "When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flocks, the work of Christmas begins. To find the hungry, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among our sisters and brothers, and to make music in the heart." With all of the anxieties of the season, with all of those anxieties that people have about the gathering dark and the fast driving and the dangerous world out there, where we can get caught up in the passions of the moment and in the angers of the moment, Christmas does two things. The anxieties that lead up to it are expiated in the moment of Christmas, in the moment of celebration. We have reached the darkest day, at least figuratively, of the calendar. There will be other dark days in our world and in our lives, but we've reached the darkest day of 2003, and we move on. We move on by making a joyful noise and saying that, yes, I am going to live my life despite the dark, despite the gloom, despite the fears. I'm going to light a match and illuminate a candle, because it reminds me that life comes back, that warmth comes back, that our spirits come back. Christmas is a time of joy and a time to find peace in our hearts, to step back from all of the noise and the excitement and the anxiety, and for a moment be calm, that that calm might nourish us in the days, in the weeks, and in the months of cold and darkness to come. The closing benediction. At Christmas, let me possess myself, be calm in mind and quiet in my heart. Let me take the time to watch the candle's light and know it is the same vast silence as the silver stars. Let me be of time dispossessed, stand by at the birth, and humbly say the name. Let me be quiet by the candle's sight, be akin to stars and lost in time. Be a disciple of truth's eternal light.